Thanks for coming along tonight to this very special event. There's actually a multiplicity of things we're celebrating here tonight. The launch of Volt's sex issue. The Photo 2022 Festival, which is an amazing program that this event is part of, that's continuing until May 2022. So many 22s in this title. May 22, 2022. And of course, the Helmut Newton exhibition, that is a Jewish Museum of Australia exhibition right upstairs. And it's part of the, it's in partnership with Photo 2022 as well. I'm Sophie, I'm the Assistant Content Editor of Volt Magazine. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land, the Yalukut Wilan Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation. I'd also like to extend my respect to elders past, present and emerging, and all First Nations people. So today's panel is centred on unpacking the amazing legacy of Helmut Newton. It's called Polarizing, Surprising, Loved and Loathed. Ali will be guiding us through the topics of censorship, photography, sex, and of course the legacy of Helmut Newton's beautiful photographic practice. And insight will be gained by our amazing panelists. We're here with Jess Brum, who is the director of the Jewish Museum of Australia, Eleni Papavilisio, did I say that right? Who is the curator of Helmut Newton in Focus. She is the senior curator of the museum and collections manager. And Justin Ridler. He's an esteemed photographer. You've seen his work in Vogue, in ID. He's internationally renowned. Thank you all for being part of the panel. I won't say too much more about the panel. I'll just quickly thank the Jewish Museum of Australia and the team here for hosting us tonight. Thank you for opening up past gallery hours and having us here. And for partnering with us on this event. Thank you also to the Volt and Heyman Design team who make Volt what it is. I'd just like to thank especially Lavinia Puccetti, who's here tonight, who is the designer of Volt's sex issue and the recent issues. You should chat to her because she's lovely and talented. I'd also like to thank Photo 2022 for partnering with Volt for the duration of the festival. We've worked on editorial content together, we've worked on events and some digital content creation. In the current issue we've got a great piece on Helmut Newton by writer Inga King, who is also here tonight and lovely and talented. I'll hand over to Brendan McCleary, who is curator of Photo 2022. Thank you for all being here, and enjoy.
Thank you, Zoe. I'm Brendan McCleary. I'm the Associate Curator with Photo 2022. If you aren't aware, there are 90 exhibitions with 123 artists all across Melbourne and regional Victoria currently, one of which is the brilliant exhibition just upstairs, so please do head up and have a look. Thank you to the Jewish Museum for having us all here today. And on the topic of sex, please go and see the show at the Centre for Contemporary Photography, particularly the show called Queering the Frame, Community Time Photography, that very much looks into the way in which sex and queerness is narrated by the people of their own history. So thank you again. I'll hand over to Ali for this. Will be a wonderful discussion.
It will be.
Yes.
Thank
Well, what an introduction. I'm going to stand up because this stool is very precarious,
so
and I feel like I'm going to break forward. So, thank you, Sophie, for that lovely introduction, and thank you all so much for coming out. It's so, so lovely to be here. I'd like to reiterate that acknowledgement of country as well. I'm from Queensland, so it's very important, yes. We love you. Representing is raining at the moment in Queensland, so I'll show you. I couldn't be more thrilled to be here. I'd like to thank the Jewish Museum and also Photo 2022's so fantastic to be able to partner with both of you to make this happen and to launch this issue with so many great friends and so many of the writers who contribute to Vault. And honestly, I just want to reiterate, we are a very small team. We do big things with a very small number of people. And I'm very indebted to Sophie and to Lavinia and Andrew, who really make it all come together. So I want to tell you a little bit about the sex issue. There's so many funny things about this magazine that I have to tell you, not the least of which is that when I started researching it and we were talking about all the ideas who we wanted to have in the magazine, the minute you start typing certain names in, you can imagine what your computer algorithm starts sending. And so that goes for my phone and also my computer. And I have a 10-year-old who just turned 11, who also likes to play Pokemon on my phone. There were a lot of...
I think he actually turned 18.
Sorry. I think I've aged him considerably. Yeah. And when we were doing the magazine and sort of coming to the final stages where we had all the proofs and we've got it all out on my computer, and of course... When you look at it, it's one on your seat there. You're going to see there's Tom of Finland and Robert Crumb, Iko Robinson, there's Robert Andy Coombs. There's so many things that are difficult to explain to a 10-year-old, but I try my best. And so it was quite interesting. I had to sort of say to him, don't go on my computer, because I was traveling a bit in state, but I could tell he'd been on there. You really need to stop doing that. So there's a couple, I've learned some big lessons in this process. And one is that it is amazing what you type. If you need to know where you can buy a good dildo, I can tell you that. Pretty much, I get all those ads. And yes, absolutely. And then the other funny thing is that when we did actually we started to market the magazine, and we put a little GIF up that Lavinia had designed so beautifully, Instagram almost immediately pulled it down, which we sort of thought would happen, but weirdly, Facebook didn't. So isn't that strange? Owned by the same company, go figure. So it didn't happen. So then Lavinia had to make a censored version, which is basically just blurring out the boobs. So, which was it was just a very interesting exercise, because one of the artists that you'll see featured in this magazine is an artist called Robert Andy Coombs, who's a queer disabled artist, and his work is so amazing. And he's fighting this incredibly long-running battle with Instagram that has been going on now for some time. You know, he's been featured by Jerry Saltz. He is a fantastic young artist, and everything he puts up just gets pulled down. And then his whole Instagram account got pulled down. Of course, the bigger debate there is whether it's to do with queerness, sexuality, or disability. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very interesting dialogue. And one of the things that he did talk about when we did an interview was that one of the things that is sort of a big taboo is to be disabled but queer. Very interesting. So we might get to that. But tonight, we're here to talk about Helmut Newton. And I think one of the things that I've been pondering a lot since Peter is still here and watching me do board, not drunk, I just want you to know.
I'm not a trap. I'm also very modern. I'm like, but you wish me team today.
Right. And I'm wearing a trench coat, which is very odd, don't you think, on topic? Yeah. Once you go up to the helmet, you do all me. It is such a great... So we're so glad that we could partner with this exhibition particularly, because I think... Obviously, the legacy of Helmut Newton is so large. He's such a big figure when we think about photography or even, I think, sexuality. And so I guess one of the questions that I want to ask you, Eleni, is how you... Okay, this show does two things. It talks about the significance of Helmut Newton to Melbourne, his significance to the Jewish community, but then, of course, it also unpacks, I guess, his transition from... wedding photographer, social photographer, yep, to arguably the most provocative photographer of the 20th century. So how do you begin to tell that story?
So thank you very much for having us tonight. And can I just say, my career as a museum curator, and I'm sure the same goes for you, Jess, I never thought that I'd find my name in a sex issue. So that's a first for me, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's
the Jewish museum
at
the side of the world. We're doing really well.
both mine and our curator, Kathy Pryor, as well. We were just deeply honoured and excited by the mention. Look, the exhibition falls within our remit initially to illuminate Jewish lives. This is what we do at the museum. These are the stories that we explore. And definitely Helmut's life was one of those. You know, he arrived to Australia because of the circumstances of, you know, Second World War and what was happening in his life and who he was, you know, what was his cultural and religious background, even though he was not, you know, religious in any way. So for us, that's where the conversation starts, really, in showcasing that history, in showcasing how his life is relevant to Melbourne and to Australia, and from there on progress the conversation and really show and offer to all visitors what they came to see, you know, that the visual feast and the excitement of seeing the real stuff here, and to demonstrate, to prove what were the steps in his path, in his career, that ultimately led to this beautiful array of photographs, the provocative, controversial array of photographs that private property, the body of images that we show upstairs, is all about. So that's the starting point, really.
So I think that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because obviously someone like Helmut Newton, the images are now synonymous with who we assume he is, right? The person that we think he is. But it is so interesting to learn about this kind of immigrant history and what you had to sort of overcome. So I wonder as well, how does, I might ask you, how the Jewish community takes it on board? Like, is it something that, I mean, how have they received those boobs upstairs?
I'm just curious. The million-dollar question. I would say, you know, it's been really interesting for us, the whole process, really, because I think the story that we tell is a revelation for everyone, those in the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community more broadly. I think Helmut's German-Jewish background is a surprise. His internment as an enemy alien and his kind of landing here is an even bigger surprise. That he then enlists in the Australian Army is the next surprise, and that he is here for 2 decades or thereabout. So I think that the response from our audience, Jewish or non-Jewish, is one of absolute curiosity. And I think from our perspective as a museum, all of the exhibitions and all of the encounters that we provide are ones that spark curiosity. In terms of, you know, the boobs, you can't miss the boobs up there. But I would say in the beautiful curation that Eleni and Kathy have done, the boobs are contextual. So you're not coming just to see large poster nudes. The shock and awe, it's not really there in that way. I think you're guided through what is a very personal and intimate story, and they become part of that story. So really, phenomenally, the community has responded in the exact way we had hoped, with a diversity of perspectives. I don't think we had anticipated a single response to the show. I think what we wanted was to enable people to come and see and then come to their own conclusions or come to their own understandings of who Helmut was and the legacy that he leaves behind.
And that is an interesting thing to think about, that idea of legacy, because I think that when you look at those images upstairs, you immediately see the influence that Helmut has had on so many photographers. I'm going to come to you in a minute. but I guess one of the things that I thought would be interesting to talk about is this idea of what is the difference between eroticism, sexuality, and nudity, and how I think we're existing in a time, you and I were just having a conversation about this, where ostensibly we're very open, we live in a very accepting time, but I think what's interesting is we're seeing a lot of conservatism from the left now. It's a lot of things where one might get cancelled for some of those images upstairs of those women. So I did want to talk about that because I think it's very interesting. Do you think, Eleni, that you could do those photographs now? And I'm talking very specifically some of those images of women. They are beautiful and extraordinary and, as Sophie said, provocative and polarizing. Do you think that if Helmut Newton was making them now, would he be cancelled potentially?
You know, I think his appeal is not as broad everywhere. There is still a lot of conversation, and there will be a lot of conversation about his work. I think that there's a lot of fans in Europe, perhaps less so in America. It's probably reflected by who is collecting the work and where the work is featured. So that conversation is ongoing. I think that those photographs would probably be made not by a white male photographer now. It would probably be somebody else behind the lens, and the models would perhaps represent the moment in time that we are right now. And there's no denying that Newton had a type. It has to do with his upbringing, Germany, that he grew up in, what was happening in Germany at the time, and what, you know, excited him, and what, you know, got him going, and what, you know, tickled his kind of, you know, fantasy. No, I think that the gaze would be someone else's. Yeah, not his. So I think that is, I don't know, we might just get to that. I don't want to be premature to the conversation, but I think that's probably where the conversation lies, and perhaps that is what we see as problematic in the work, you know, that he was in an industry, because of course he was not a sole agent, you know, he serves a large commercial industry, a large enterprise, a production line, if you will, that operated in a very similar way and under a very specific gaze. And his work was welcomed, his work was provocative, and, you know, he attracted the clientele that he did precisely because of that. So, yeah, I think we are, and I think that's also part of his legacy. The hindsight, you know, that retrospectively we're able to now have these conversations.
Yeah.
So that's a mirror, I guess, on ourselves and how far we've come in that discussion to be able to analyze them today.
And I wonder in terms of that, you know, because we're thinking about Terry Richardson, for example, or Bruce Weaver, and obviously there's a whole lot of anecdotal information about their behaviour, etc. But it's interesting how now those things are not separated out at all. And so we cease to be able to see the art or the form aside from these things, you know, like these things that transpire, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. But it is interesting, isn't it? Because we come to those Helmut Newton images, and as you said, you have type. They're Amazonian, for want of a better word, aren't they? And sort of Teutonic goddesses. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And I think that also what there was another conversation that we had in the lead up to the exhibition, that there was enough evidence actually that Newton worked very professionally and very respectfully with his clients and with the models that were in front of the lens. And I guess, you know, where controversy lies in some of the other names you mentioned is precisely because of the fact that they didn't, that they crossed the line, you know. And also the fact that he stated in an interview that he didn't care, I'm not, you know, this probably sounds even more objectifying, you know, but that he didn't care about the model, you know, about her story, about where she come from or what she looked like or whatever, but the model serves his own fantasy, you know, is there to be a part of that cinematic view that he's creating when he's behind the lens. So the model is part of the story, is part of the narrative. So that's the relationship that he had with all the women that he worked with. And it would be useful somewhere in the conversation as well to mention the women that influenced him.
Perfectly placed as we are.
That's right. Well, actually, yes, you may turn your gaze to the three images here. And, of course, you'll see some more further up in the exhibition, original images by Eva, who was the fashion photographer, Jewish-German fashion photographer that Newton did his apprenticeship with and later was promoted to assistant in Berlin. You know, you'll explore all this as you go upstairs, but he started photographing at the age of 12. He knew from a very young age that his path was in photography. That's really, you know, where his heart was. He was super excited about cinema, but he knew that anything to do with cinema would take too long, and he didn't have the patience or the stamina, so photography was for him. And actually, I think he said that anything over 3 days, the project anything over 3 days is not worth doing, so he was just kind of getting it out. But anyway, I digress. Eva was a great influence on him. She was herself a prolific fashion photographer, masterful technically what she did in Berlin. He spent many years there with her, honing his craft and understanding the work that that she did. And he says in his autobiography that he worshipped the ground that she walked on. So a major influence, and I think one of the great losses in his life in that after he fled Berlin in 1938, Eva was too late to respond to that exodus, and she believed that things would change. You know, it couldn't happen to her, and then she ended up being murdered in one of the concentration camps in 1942. And he always acknowledged Eva later on in his career. And actually, it's interesting to think about photography in Melbourne and what it is that he brings here in terms of his photographic practice, because everything that he learns in his her studio. The way that photography worked at the time, you know, all those analog processes, the dark room, everything that he would have done as a young boy, he brings to Melbourne, you know, the same methodology, the same work. And of course, later in his life, June Newton, his wife, who he met while she was modeling, she was a, you know, young actor, she becomes his lifelong creative partner, his you know, his life partner. And she was there at all the projects, behind
always
the scenes.
That's one of the best images upstairs, actually, that iconic image of the model looking at herself and June sitting there watching him photograph. It's such an extraordinary image,
Starting from his mother, I guess, from his early years, you know, a female force that really shaped him and gave him this early sense of personality, his aesthetic, you know, the world that he lived in was very much, shaped by her, you know, the haircut that he hated, all the velvet little suits that he despised, and he was grateful for his father when he gave him a haircut, to all those other aesthetic and cultural influences that were to come further down his life. You know, there was women there at every step of the way.
And you're very right about that. He was always very acknowledging of the women in his life. And I remember seeing those Thelma Newton images as a young girl and thinking and knowing instinctively that they were powerful and not feeling like, you know, because it was different to looking at Playboy, which I encountered as a young person through. Like, poor Leo, I refer back to my poor son who's now seeing things she never did. But there is a difference, right? Like, I knew there was a difference, even as a young person, and looking at those images. I was aware that those women were extraordinary and powerful and strong. And I didn't feel weird about it. I just wanted to know more about who they were. And so it's so interesting, that idea of the gaze and how early, I guess, that settles on you and how you think about it. So I want to come to you, Justin, as the photographer in the room and someone who also teaches photography. You are an active photographer. You're working and thinking and making, but you're teaching as well. So can you talk about what Thelma Newton has meant to you, or also other photographers who are, I guess, in the same realm, and how you think about that idea of the gaze?
Sure. I think what Thelma Newton meant to me, I think as I was growing up, I think I share a similar story. You know, I came to fashion photography when I was very, very young, probably 8 or 9 years old. My aunties actually used to collect old Italian Vogues and French Vogues, and we would sit on my grandmother's staircase with my other cousins, and I would pore over them, and they were fabulous. Like, I would make their own dresses and all of that stuff. But I think I came very early into this notion of, I didn't really know that it was fashion photography. I thought it was just a fun thing to do, to look at, you know, these beautiful women in Vogue magazine. So that was sort of my first entry point. And then later, I think, when I realized that I wanted to be a photographer and entered into university and started studying, Thelma Newton, to me, was sort of seen as the old guard, really.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Like,
that's interesting.
I studied, I finished university in 2001, I think. And so for me, it was like sort of Thelma Newton, Cecil Beaton, Richard Avedon, you know, names like that everyone in this room probably know quite well. But we saw them as being kind of almost like the proto-photographers, you know. Mm-hmm. We were looking at their work as being kind of the formula, if you will, of how to craft images. Later on, my viewpoint on my craft became far more textural, and I started looking outside of those initial kind of, you know, entry points. But I think in the formative, I guess, stages of my career, it was really quite siloed in terms of when we were looking.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and also potentially unfortunate as well, because there were a lot of voices that were cut away from that that obviously quite textured dialogue that could have happened, but we didn't really look sort of outside of that. And then later on, I fell in love with Sally Mann and Sarah Moon, and that just took my breath away, and really kind of the rest is history, really. So I think that's sort of what Helmut represented to me then. What he represents to me now is somewhat differently. I think I, like everyone in this room, have kind of graduated past the kind of particular way of representing women that seemed to occur at that stage in the photographic canon. And I sort of see his work lensed by the time that he was an operator, you know. I think, like you said earlier, it would be very, very difficult for Helmut to create the types of images that he's creating now without crafting an extremely specific narrative around it. And I think that really is the clincher. You can create work. You could create that work, absolutely. People are still creating that work, but the way that they're creating that work is also they're crafting narrative and dialogue, and they're being very open about their practices, and they're being very open about the way that they're engaging with that sort of that area of subject matter. So sex is definitely not off the table, not by a long, long shot.
Yeah.
I hope.
Because we just did a whole magazine about it.
But I think the conversation around crafting sexual images requires specificity, and it requires dialogue. And we were talking about this upstairs, but the way that you solve problems is through talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we were talking about the thorny thing about getting cancelled.
Yes.
And,
there's no cancelling.
There's no cancelling. It's really dumb. And it sucks. To cancel anyone because it's stupid. Have a conversation instead. So anyway,
yes,
my point is,
please.
It's very interesting that you mentioned Sally Mann because those are extraordinary. I'm shouting, sorry. They're incredible images, and Sally Mann is someone who, you know, really has been cancelled so many times before cancelling was a thing.
Isn't
that interesting? Because, and one of the things that when we were putting this magazine together, we had been talking about sex. Which was funny to say as well, all the time. So I was like, let's talk about sex again. And we were thinking very much about the issue and how we wanted to think about nudity and beauty and sex and eroticism and what all those things are and how they're different and how they may or may not be the same thing, and why we confuse nudity with sexuality, and that's a really big one, isn't it? And I mean, that's the case with Sally Mann too.
Definitely. I think it's also like the way that you inherently witness and engage with a photograph is textured by your own life experience, and also by the times. It's kind of this two-way mirror. There's you and all of your life experiences, the photograph and the artist on the other side, and also to a certain extent the moment, you know, like the images that we're looking at today, hopefully later today, lens by this moment in time, are characteristically so different to walking into the same gallery if it was curated exactly the same way, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Vastly different experience, and will be again, I'm sure. We were talking about this just now, but like, with every culture there comes a counterculture, and one thing that I have seen evidence of is that there are photographers working in, I'd imagine you would kind of describe them as being relatively dangerous practices for contemporary kind of ethical standards, and that voice is, that type of work is definitely a subcurrent now, and potentially we'll see a time where it flips its head and we start seeing much more erotic work, or we start seeing the counterpoint of whatever today's aesthetics and ethics, because they're quite similar or kind of bound together, that might end up happening. But yeah, the Sally Mann thing is kind of an interesting tangential conversation on its own, because I mean, they're her children that she photographed. And personally, I mean, I saw those photographs and just completely fell in love with this presentation of family that she had kind of curated, and the work that she creates is so textured in its nuance. It's, you know, very, very beautiful work. If you haven't seen her work, please do check it out, Sally Mann. But yeah, it's different
You were saying something upstairs about your students and how you have found that they either go one way or the other. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because I think that's really interesting that we live in this quite confusing time, I would say.
Yeah, of course, some of my students are here tonight, which is really heartening, so thank you for attending.
See, he is a nice guy. It's
very lovely to see you. I see quite a lot of, quite an array, I guess, of photographic opinions come through the door. I teach at RMIT in the VA and sometimes in the Masters. By and large, there'll be a dominant idea or a dominant kind of rhetoric in the classroom every semester, and sometimes it's for example, George Floyd's murder, it was very much discussing race recently, or more recently it's been discussing gender, and those things are really front and centre of the conversation, which is marvellous to see people that are young, ignited and brilliant, creating work that is, that has space for discourse. But the counterpoint of that is also true, and what I have also seen is occasionally you see someone come through, I guess the pack, if you want to describe it like that, and their vision and their voice will be laser sharp and so precise and vastly different to the aesthetic principles and ideas that have been kind of discussed more kind of in a more kind of tribal way, I guess, by the rest of the group. So that I find really fascinating, and they're always kind of an outlier, but typically speaking, their vision's really, really sharp. So that's kind of an interesting thing, more of an observation, really.
You had an idea about how you could avoid...
Oh, okay.
Well, we were talking about how you set up, like, a space, as it were, and you had a great suggestion for that.
So, part of the issue of creating ethical representations of people in a photographic sense revolves around the conversation of consent. I think we can all kind of agree with where that sort of concept stems from. There's evidence to suggest that people that work in other industries deal with this situation all the time, and also various sexual practices also deal with this issue all the time. So what I think is that, like, if your work discusses sexuality, then you should take a cue from, like, the kink situation and have a safe word. Or have an array of safe words. You know, maybe you have, maybe you're, you know, it's stop, it's a, you know, green, yellow, red, or pineapple, or raspberry.
I like it. I think it's a very simple idea. I think we've got to put it in play.
It's a simple idea. It's probably not well thought out. I'm sure there's nuance to it, but I mean, why not give something a go? Because, you know, I think that certainly it requires a more textured dialogue with between artist and subject, and I think that having devices like that would potentially help the situation going forward. Because it's also often when you're crafting images with a person, there's the excitement of the moment, and you're putting your ideas and your energy and your enthusiasm, as well as all your technical expertise, into the scenario, whatever that might be, and the person that you're photographing brings their narrative and their expressiveness and their beauty and their potentially their performance to that as well. And people kind of get caught up in this, like, wonderful little dance that occurs. But then it can sometimes go a little bit too far. So discussing those boundaries early on in the piece, or at least having solutions that you can use in real time, would be a really useful tool on both sides of the equation.
That's a really good point, because if you think about Helmut Newton, I think what is interesting about those images upstairs is they're still images, and we are living in a world where we're very used to moving images, and so we think about Nick Knight, who really pioneered, you know, with Show Studio, pioneering those moving images, and how that's part of, I guess, vernacular now. It's how we understand a lot of fashion. Photography is fashion film now. But perhaps the potency of those images upstairs is because they're still, and also quite small. Aren't they? What do you think, Eleni? Like, there's something about that scale that is so intimate. What is interesting about it is that you do lean really close, and then you're really close to the boobs. So, but that's quite powerful, isn't it? That sort of that motion.
It is, although I was talking with someone earlier who has a collection of the sumo books.
Oh, wow.
I don't know, you can put your hand up
yes,
if you want.
Yes, the sumo books. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it is, you know, Newton did play with scale as well, and those the series of works with the clothed women and the naked women, see a common, they came big, you know, they were massive, they were life-size. But there is definitely something about the cinematic quality of the work and the ambiguity that comes with that, and the fact that, you know, the viewer's gaze is invited into a scene where you're not sure, is it the beginning, is it the middle, is it, you're not sure what you've actually walked in, and this, you know, am I comfortable looking at this, am I not comfortable? And I think it's worth thinking about where those works also initially appeared, that they appeared in magazines.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And you know, your beautiful comment about how, what is the relationship between the photographer and the you know, subject? Mm. How does that all fit in within the super fast paced fashion industry, you know, where the client wants
a very specific
look, and only the boy, the girl, the person that has that look gets the job, you know? That was very much the industry that Telmet worked in. So yeah, I mean, I love the scale of those prints, you know, they're wonderful. And the textual quality as well, you know, the analog photography world, you know, all of that, that, you know, he allows us to, you know, to explore with that body of work. But, there is also a number of issues that are worth, discussing and analyzing as a result of those 70s and 80s photographs.
Mm-hmm. And so, as director of museum, I'm interested too in how, we look at how we can, I guess, reframe these images for a contemporary audience. Because what is so amazing when you go upstairs, if you haven't seen it already, to see those early fashion photographs, which are so polite and staid. But even so, you and I were talking, they're quite polite, but then there's one, you know, where she's holding in like a sword.
Yeah.
It's like a weapon. He's always playing, isn't he, with those things. So I'm just wondering, as the director of the museum, was it sort of a no-brainer? You're like, we have to do this show because it's going to explode expectations, or...?
I feel like you're in the inner workings of my brain, and then there was the conversation that you have with the team, and then there's the conversation you have at a board level, and then there's the conversation you have in a room like this, and all of those conversations are very different. But yes, the initial thought was, this is a show that we have to have and we have to bring to audiences here. And I think the primary question for us is why. Why is this a show that the Jewish Museum needs to present? And I think it kind of goes back to that earlier point of the unique story that we can tell because we are the Jewish Museum, and all the layers in Helmut's kind of personal life that lead him to become the icon and the provocateur that we know him to be. And were you to see the show anywhere else, would you have that layering?
Yes.
Would you be able to delve that deep into his personal history and come up with the context that we've given upstairs? But yes, we certainly played and played again, and play's not the right word, because it's significant and substantial thinking around, is a museum a place for these works? And the answer that we came to was, yes, for a contemporary museum it is.
Yeah.
You know, we consider ourselves a space for coming and exploring and viewing, but much more than that now. You know, we're a surface for, or a springboard for, conversation and dialogue, and if that conversation is hard and challenging, then we're doing our job. You know, it's hard to be confronted with images that through a contemporary lens make us feel uncomfortable. And they do. And you know, I was thinking about that point, that we all come to looking at these images with our own personal kind of nuance and perspective. And I would say that for our team, on any given day, at any given hour, we might have a different thought when we're up there in the gallery. I think I keep going kind of back and forth in terms of my interpretation, but the fact that there is space to have those interpretations and for those interpretations to be flipped on their head, that's, I think, what I'm proud of for bringing it to the museum and to Melbourne.
And, congratulations on that, because I think there is that thing that, I mean, I've written quite a lot about art and fashion, and I think it's always very interesting because, you know, people like to preclude fashion and sort of say it's, you know, a folly. But I think when you look at, like, the legacy of Helmut Newton, you can see there's so much going on. It's very much an engagement with feminism in the 70s. Yeah. Like, he is thinking. Like, he arguably was a feminist. And a lot of people disagree with that. Mm-hmm. But I think he was engaging and thinking. I also think it's so interesting, too, that we talked about him being polarizing. Sophie and I were trying to think about how we would describe this talk. And but it is so interesting, isn't it, what offends people? Like, it is such an interesting concept, because one thing that offends someone does not offend another person. And so these are questions that one has to ask as a director of a museum, don't you? You have to think about what could be offensive or not be offensive. And does it even matter? Do you know what I mean? I don't know. Does it matter? Like, I kind of want to exist in a world where my buttons are pushed, but not everyone does, right?
I mean, I think we got to the point, and the terminology is really important. We would never want, we're not out to offend anyone, but I think more importantly, we don't want to alienate anyone. So how do we create an experience and a journey that we know deep inside is open and inclusive and warm? And, you know, that kind of, that script around museums being safe spaces, I believe in it to a point, because you've come here to look and to interrogate, and there is a safety in doing it in this kind of context. But I think more than that, the scaffolding that we've provided through the curatorial lens provides that safety in a way, because it's giving context to it. So you're not looking at these images in isolation. But yes, we will have people that come and see the show that feel deeply offended by the content, and that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay.
And I think that's a great shift too in kind of contemporary practice for museums and galleries. It's okay that you don't love the show. It's okay that you feel deeply offended, and it's okay that you tell us, because we want to hear.
Yeah.
You know what?
No, I think that's the best takeaway. Like, no, you're not meant to like everything.
No.
Okay, this is a really big question, and any of you can answer it. But why do you think we do confuse sexuality with nudity? Or nudity with sexuality? I think it's a really interesting thing. I'm married to an artist who frequently paints our children, has painted them when they were young and nude. It's a big thing, you know, and similar to Sally Mann, had received a lot of negative things, but it's so interesting. I'm just curious, what do you think? Why do we do that? Why is that our first reaction, is to assume that if something is nude, it's sexual?
Sorry.
Go.
I don't think that it's a product of one thing or a product of only one person's instinct or imagination. Or I think we're trained to see the world in the way that we do. You know, I think every image you look at, every painting, and perhaps that's why Newton's work is even more shocking, because of the medium that is used. You know, if it was paintings or if it was lithography or anything else, maybe we'd have a different reaction to it. You know, but it is photography that plays with reality, or that plays with our understanding of what happened or what did not happen, or what was behind the scenes or what wasn't, or what was outside of the frame that was photographed. But I guess, you know, we look at a body and our reaction is probably the training and education that we've had from our early years, from our formative years, you know, where some things were good, some things were bad, some things were accepted, and it's each person's own moral code and response to life, I think. That's one side of it. Just to go back to, and sorry, actually, maybe Justin, you want to, yes, go. Yeah.
Hi. Yes, and also, though, I think if I take it to a personal experience perspective, when I have crafted images of bodies and the forces that act upon them, sometimes you don't think about them being bodies at all. Mm. Sometimes you're really only just looking at form and colour and momentum and impact, and that can be a moment where you're working on composition, and then you kind of go up a level and then you're like, oh, these are people now, we need to sort of engage with them on that level. Mm. So the process, I think, is certainly as textured as life is textured, you know, you're in multiple layers of it simultaneously and trying to make incremental decisions based on, like, how things are feeling from a compositional point of view, and then you kind of lift out of that and go, well, is it reading well, though? Mm-hmm. So sometimes the people are people, and sometimes they're really just not.
Interesting, very interesting.
You can never mic back.
Did you want to ask?
Just to go back to the point that we were making about, you know, that Jess made about the curation of the photography over the course of the exhibition, you know, both Kathy Pryor, our curator, and myself, we looked at so many images. We became, you know, very familiar with Private Property, which, you know, came to us as a provocative body of work and all of that. But I found myself, and I can just stay within the room, I found myself quite, I don't know, sick of or disturbed or annoyed by the 1950s images, you know? By, you know, all those images that we so easily and readily call as glamorous, you know, elegant, beautiful. And it was a time that was really hard for women, you know? Like, it was very hard to escape from that ideal. You know, for what, you know, you had to have the little waist, the beautiful dress, everything, you know, your home had to be just so, the kids clean and ready, you know, whereas at least, you know, if there's any comfort in, you know, the imagery that he takes later on in the 70s and 80s, accepting that it is all white women and, you know, women are very much at the center of, you know, the photograph, at least you accept that it is a time where women are out in the workforce, you know, they have a say for themselves. There's a lot of battles to be fought, as they are today, no doubt, but there were options.
Yes.
You know, there were options. So
that's so interesting, because when you say that, when you go upstairs, you do start to see those 50s images as almost perverse. there's a perversity there, because we've moved on so much from that kind of trope, I guess. Yeah, very interesting. And you said the thing about painting and drawing, and it is interesting because in this issue we've got Tom of Finland, of course, and they are, like, Instagram did not like the Tom of Finland. Lavinia had to blur out a lot on the
gram again.
And then also Robert Crumb, and this is a funny anecdote, but I have to share it because we were so excited that Robert Crumb said, yeah, sure. We're like, wow, this is incredible. And the most elegant and formal and polite email to the writer who I'd engaged, and dear Mr. Dow, I'd very much like to be part of that. I'd like to send you some images, so I'm scanning my notebooks for you, and I'm going to send them to you. Would it be possible, please, to send me a copy to this address, warmest regards, R. Crumb. And we were all like, look at this email, this is unbelievable. Like, the most, you know, quite out there images. Robert Crumb is fantastic and so delightful to deal with. He's going into my big book that Sophie knows I have of nice artists. I have another one of not so nice
artists. It's the bigger book.
You're in the nice one. And then just before I die, I'm going to publish it.
I feel like we all want to come back to that
conversation. I'm opening one about manners. So anyway, I would like to open it to questions now, if you guys are happy with that, because I feel like people have things they want to say about sex and they want to ask tricky questions, or they just want to point something out. So would anybody like to ask a question? This is a friendly space right now. So yeah, hit us with a question.
I just wanted to talk about the cancel culture,
yes,
particularly with Helmut's work, and also a quote that he made, famous quote. I think it goes something like, all photographers are voyeurs. If they deny it, they're either liars or they're idiots. And I simply posted that on my Instagram site just recently and was totally challenged.
Wow.
Are you saying that's what you, because I'm a photographer,
okay,
are you saying that's your genre? And are you saying that's what you agree with? Mm-hmm. And are you objectifying women? And I said, no, all I'm doing is posting history.
Yeah.
This is what he physically said.
Mm.
And so it's meant to be challenging. All art is meant to be challenging.
Yes.
And yet, I had to remove it, otherwise I was at risk of losing my account.
Yeah, right. I got here with that. It's so shocking. My 16-year-old daughter was like, Mom, I can't believe all of that.
Oh.
And
Give me a saxophone.
This is why I'm wearing a trench coat, but it's all going to change.
No, that's a very very interesting point that you make. It's extremely interesting. And so, yeah, so I got this, like, terrifying message from Instagram saying, we will take down your account. And I was like, wow, that's so crazy. And I think it takes, like, one person to complain. And Instagram goes, psh, like, that is so crazy. Yeah. So, sorry, to come back to Robert Andy Coombs is in this issue. The poor guy. He had, like, three different accounts, and they keep cancelling him. And as he said, he's 99% sure it's because he's disabled, not because of the content, which is so, so interesting. Would someone else please ask a question? Right at the back there, just shout it out.
It's not so much a question, but I wanted to throw an idea or a concept out. Censorship and nudity and transparency. We're looking at images on a wall, but we know that images go so much further. With Instagram, we have NFTs, the proliferation of imagery across the digital ether means that nudity and taking one image, one nude image, rather than it just being in a gallery and being sold to a person or being part of an edition, it no longer is that or wasn't that in the time that it was created.
That's interesting.
And now we have to think about this when we're free. We have to think about this when we're dealing with models that have personalities and presentations that are beyond the actual creation of art. What do you think about this? How does this affect you as a creator? How do you think about this as a collector?
Great question.
That's a very
great,
good
great statement.
Everything. Amazing situation. I think about that. I mean, certainly it's sort of target territory, isn't it? Like, to craft images in today's landscape, today's technological landscape. No, I think that it's definitely a valid point, and certainly something that we as creators need to address and keep, like, front of mind when we're crafting these images. I wonder whether that's, again, solved by more intricate dialogue at the beginning of the creative process, particularly, if you're working in with images that could be construed as being sensitive in any way, saying, where would you like these to live? Is it appropriate for me to post these to my Instagram? And then being fairly explicit about that, if I post them to the gram, that's forever. Is that okay with you? Is that a choice that you would like for me to go ahead with? And I understand that sometimes people make decisions and then later on they could regret them, but at least the dialogue is being had, you know? I'd say probably if you're a creative person and you're making images of sensitivity, and you know if you're a creative person that those images are going to be sensitive, you should double down on that conversation. It's sort of something that you need to have with yourself as well, like, how will I use these pictures, and what's the intention behind them, and where is the projected what's the projected outcome of this project, say? But I think these are all, again, problems that are solvable with like, nuanced conversation with the people that you work with. That would be my stance on it.
And the irony being that, you know, we are talking about Helmut Newton, but as we speak, there's, like, the most hardcore porn just freely available on the web, right? And that, again, this is something, I mean, that's horrendous and terrifying as a parent, which is very interesting. And we just like to talk briefly about Madonna and Beeple.
Oh, my God.
Has up if anyone's seen Madonna's NFT? Some of you, you're all going to have to Google it right now. It's quite intense. I don't know why I want to talk about that, but it just seems shocking and terrible.
Shocking and... Well, hang on. Shocking and terrible.
And way more offensive than Helmut Newton.
I mean, I was halfway through eating my eggs and polenta this morning when I'm sorry, it has to be said, I just saw a tree growing out of Madonna's vagina on my Instagram.
Google it, people.
Please Google it. Wow. Yeah. Please don't cancel me. It was my terrible.
No way. Not going to add to it.
No, it's bad.
But I digress. Would somebody else like to have a question? One more question, then we might shoot upstairs and see the show.
It's probably more to Elodie and Jess, but the choice to not have extended labels as part of the offering, is that to do with the interpretation of Helmut's work? And obviously you've done a lot of work towards opening the dialogue as we are today. But I suppose as a museum versus a gallery space, where kind of did the logic come from to not explain the story of Helmut in your artifacts of, you know, the Queen Mary and, you know, his very Melbourne experience and his struggle as a migrant coming from Austria and Germany and that settling into his life in Melbourne and beyond.
I think with every exhibition, our intention is to create an immersive environment. So the intention with Helmet, which actually has a lot more text than our previous exhibition, to our kind of admission, was to allow for the visitor to come in and read the imagery, and develop a relationship, if you will, with what's in front of them in a visual sense, and use the information, use the digital room sheet that's available through the QR code as a reference point when they need to rely upon, you know, the geography or the date or the specific detail around each work. That was our intention. And I guess it's that added layer of inviting people to read an image, decide upon themselves where they are, where they sit with it, without having our voice behind it or any sense of kind of a didactic text that steers them in one way or another, but give the art and give the necessary information, obviously, with it as it comes with the object labels. I hope I've answered that.
Yeah. One other kind of comment from me, and I guess it's always good to have a shout out. The accompaniment to the exhibition, which sits in the digital realm, which is Spotlight on Helmut Newton, then becomes an exploration of a number of those extended themes and framings and conversations. So while you won't necessarily read kind of an encyclopedia out there or extended labels that gesture toward the kind of the broader narrative around Helmut's life, the idea is that we hope you'll all go home and explore a little more on our webpage and then come back and be part of programs like these. So the exhibition itself isn't intended to do, I often say to our team, and it's such a strange phrase, but it's not intended to do all the heavy lifting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That the exhibition sits alongside a really profound and meaningful program that starts to join the dots between a number of the things that you've seen upstairs.
Well, thank you. I think we're going to leave it there. Now, I know you probably all want to talk a lot more about sex. I can just tell you all do. But what we would like to do is to invite you to come up and see the exhibition now. And I just want to thank our panelists again tonight. And thank you again to the Jewish Museum and Photo 2022. It is hard to say. And Justin Riddle for being on this panel. We're very grateful. It's such an honour to launch this issue. It's been such fun working on this issue. And like I said, it's not a one focus of what sex is, it's everything, we hope. We try to cover off a lot, and we hope it will get you thinking and talking. And I just wanted to say on behalf of Vault, thank you for supporting independent publishing. We're very grateful for that. And what a beautiful audience. Now go and look at those boots.